Chapter 3. Terra, the Imperial Palace, Check 0, 004126. Lady Cavallinera Brassanus, Knight Abyssal of the Sisters of Silence, sat perfectly upright at the head of the table, hands on her armoured thighs. She was clad in antique crimson armour, etched with ancient Terran designs, extinct languages, ideograms representative of concepts relevant to a mythic age. Parchment strips attached to the armour with wax seals decorated her body with an impenetrable, spiderish script. The collar of her battle plate was high, obscuring her mouth and nose, and leaving only the dark matter emptiness of her stare between her and the world. She was an untouchable, a blank, one in a trillion. A homozygous carrier of the mutant pariah gene that rendered her impervious to all forms of psychic assault. A useful trait, if an unnerving one to be around. The High Lords, those that Courland had demanded attend, adopted various manifestations of mental brace against the negative pressure of the woman's mind and the inexorable pull on their souls. Joskina Tull and Fabricator General Kubik sat together along one side of the long table, with Admiral Lansung, Venand, and Gibran facing them on the other. Drakan Vangerich sat somewhere between attention and repose at the far end. Though not officially represented on the High 12, the assassin had become as much a part of proceedings as the Lord Commander himself, and Courland suspected that a few of his less informed peers had forgotten that they technically outranked him. In spite of recent damage, the Clanium Library remained very much the overstuffed vanity project that Lansung had made of it. For all the Lord Admiral's faults in matters of grand strategy and statecraft, however, given a small enough stage in which to operate, he was a perfectly able military commander. The chronometric displays, hololiths and loop projectors that had been installed at great expense in place of the books and other portable storage media that had previously filled the shelves actually by accident or design made for an excellent consultation chamber. The snarling visage of an orc filled the big screens that surrounded the conference table, not frozen exactly, but jerking from one millisecond to the next, and then back again, as though eager to be done but barred from moving on. A pair of fuzzy verticals ran through the image at the exact same spot on every display. The brute's crusted nose and gaping mouth were up close to the capturing lens, its expression very much what one would expect from an orc having its skull crushed in a Black Templar dreadnought's power fist. With every twitch around the time point, the orc's eyes were noticeably squashed closer together and then released back. Energetic emanations sparked from the cracks in the orc's skull, generating strange, unsettling imagery on the data medium that became overt only when, as now, the playback was held. Courland was not at all surprised that everyone, barring Joskina Tull, he judged by her rapt expression, had already seen the Zelenic 4 footage. He was resigned to the fact that any information known to more than two people within the palace walls quickly became common knowledge. "This," said Courland, "as you are probably all by now aware, is live footage, retrieved from a battle between a force of Black Templars under Venerable Magnaric and an orc warband. It was returned to Terra at great cost by the Interdictor, in the belief of her crew that what it shows is the weakness that we have all been looking for in the orcs. They're psychers. We simply did not have the means to exploit this information until now." Ignoring the intrigued murmur from the lords, Courland reached across Lady Brassanus to depress the intercom switch set into a panel at the head of the table. "Brother Thane, have you located Magos Laurentis?"
"I have. It seems he took a wrong turn at the playback control room."
"Please escort him in, brother." One of the grand paired doors creaked inwards, disturbing the roost of Herald Seraphim clustered over the lintel block with squawks of "Thane! Thane!" The chapter master of the Fist Exemplar held the door open, and with an oddly asynchronous click of metal feet on the parquet tiles, Phaeton Laurentis scuttled towards the table. There was almost nothing left of the Magos who had been assigned to the Imperial Fist's second company to study the extermination of the Adamantuan Chromes. The eye, perhaps, nestled in the center of an insectile reconstruction of Vox Thief pickups, mechano-sensors, and emotive carapace. That, and the occasional quirk of personality. The rest was a reconstruction, and, to Corlin's mind, not one that the Magos biologists or anyone could have deserved. Laurentis circled the table on a tripod of articulated metal limbs that flicked up the skirts of ill-fitting robes and distributed data packets with flicks of mechadendrites. His voice, too, was harshly synthesized.
You have begun to discuss the Orc Mysticus breed, correct?
He pivoted his eyeball to Courland, who nodded.
Good. Good. I apologize for my tardiness, Lord Commander, but I have studied this footage frame by frame 1,011 times, and I have many demands on my time.
As do we all, muttered Lansung. Once, perhaps, Laurentis would have been human enough to note the not-so-subtle jab, but no longer.
As the venerable Dreadnought Marshal was cogent enough to recognize, the Orc Psykers are their weakness. The mind of each individual Orc operates as a psychic dynamo of sorts, responsive to the Orc's mood and growing exponentially in power in the presence of other Orcs.
The Green Roar,
said Gibran, the hooded paternoval envoy of the Narvis nobility, clearly more discomforted than the others by the psychic blank space generated by the Night Abyssal.
We are familiar with the effect.
The Orc Psykers are able to absorb that power and release it in concentrated, directed form. As we observed on Ulanor, the harder we attack, the stronger the Orc psychic field becomes. But as you have all seen, he gestured to the image frozen in grayscale on the pict feed, the flow of power can be reversed.
Potentially useful, said Vangerich, flicking through his packet, seemingly idly. But we would have to draw these psychers out in order to exploit it, and the Orcs seem wiser than to let that happen. It didn't happen on Ulanor.
Which is why we must capture one for ourselves, said Corland. Ideally, more than one.
At least three, in fact, said Laurentis. The Basilicon Astra and the work of the Grand Experiment have identified three Orc colonies where the genotype of the Mysticus subspecies has been confirmed. It is the opinion of my fellow Magi biology that the observed effect can be artificially induced and targeted to destructive effect.
An operation on this scale will require considerable manpower, said Lansung,
with some of his usual bluster now he was on familiar ground.
And firepower. We are a council of 12. We can't in good conscience authorize that kind of operation without a full vote. Lord Veriult at least should be here to speak for the Astra Militarum.
Tull and Gibran nodded gravely. Vangerich sat back in his chair and looked at the ceiling with a long sigh.
Let me be clear so there can be no further misunderstandings.
Courland leaned forward. Everyone bar Vangerich and Kubik shifted noticeably back.
This is not a discussion. I do not ask for opinions, and this is not a vote. There is no time to muster a fleet, and even if there were, the unfortunate truth is that after Ulanor, there is no longer the capacity to resource an expedition on that scale. We must learn to act quickly and decisively, which is why Deathwatch kill teams Umbra, Stalker and Tigress, under the command of Sergeants Kjavik, Tyris and Tulway, and supported by the Sisters of Silence, have already been deployed to those worlds.
Already deployed?
Venand enunciated each word as though they were too important to share a sentence.
You make it sound so ominous, said Vangerich.
Isn't it?
Venand turned back to Courland. The Senatorum acknowledges the necessity of the Last War and the Death Watch and their effectiveness. But many of us, myself included, do not exactly like either. And now you appear to enjoy sole command of both. As I understand it, you have even begun extending recruitment beyond those chapters directly affected by the losses on Ulanor. She referred down to the extensive pile of handwritten notes in front of her.
Tyrus and Tulwe are of the Raven Guard and the Stormlords. Just how big is the Death Watch now, Lord Commander? You can't circumvent the Codex Astartes with loopholes.
Must we have the same argument? Said Vangarich.
Query,
said Kubik, speaking in his harshly mechanized monotone for the first time since Thane had brought them all to their seats.
Objection has been raised to those of us not present, but what of those of us who are? Why are we here? Because I need ships. I need the best navigators to pilot them and good men to crew them.
As soon as Curland said this, the atmosphere in the room changed. It became circumspect, the lords each retreating to some private mental fief to survey its limits, what it held of value, and most importantly, what it was worth in trade. Curland banished it back to the corners with a rap of his knuckles on the table.
I say again, this is not a request.
It's not that,
said Lansung. He waved a pudgy hand vaguely.
There simply aren't the ships to give you.
The Autocephalax Eternal emerged from a most recent battle relatively unscathed. I will take everything. I can take no more from the Space Marine chapters without blunting their own effectiveness.
The damage to the flagship remains extensive, Lord. Resources are scarce, and Mars has had other priorities.
The Synod of Mars is united in its support of Terra,
Kubik interrupted with a blurt of code.
But the Basilicon Astra suffered losses in the invasion of Ulanor, and we too have few ships to offer.
Curland returned to the Chartist speaker, Tull, who looked apologetically at something else, and shrugged.
The Inquisition has ships, said Venant softly, filling Tull's silence like a master rhetorician. Experienced crews, the best navigators in the Imperium.
Gibran nodded, unasked for confirmation that this was no exaggeration.
I will not give away control of the Death Watch, said Curland. The Adeptus Astartes are not to be handed out like favours.
You said yourself that the Death Watch is too great a responsibility for one man. Even if we were to have faith in you to use them honourably, what of your successor as Lord Commander? What of theirs? No, only the Inquisition can provide the proper authority for such a force, but it does not answer to one leader alone. I am but a representative of many, as is Veritas.
Curland rubbed the urge to snarl away on the back of his hand and glanced sideways to Lady Brassanus, who held his gaze with a frosty remove.
How many ships do you have?
Several dozen operating from bases close enough to be contactable. Escorts all the way up to Black Ship Class. They were built for transportation. I can't promise it will be comfortable, but I have the capacity to transport several thousand men and their equipment wherever they need to go.
Curland let out a rasp of frustration.
Very well, Inquisitor. As soon as this conference is over, I will transfer a full authority over the Death Watch to the Inquisition. But these are my conditions. First, the Death Watch is to be limited to chapter strength. Second, I retain the power to disband them when the current crisis is past. And third, with all respect, you are no military woman, and the Inquisition is no military organization. I will appoint a space marine to oversee all strategic aspects. Agreed.
Do you have someone in mind for the role?
Curland met Venan's calculating eyes, too old for her young-looking face, tried to tease out what the woman was thinking. Thane had been in effective charge of Death Watch operations since Sacratus, and was clearly the best fit for the role, but Curland knew as soon as the thought arose that Thane, his right hand, was too close to him to be acceptable. The same might also be said of Beaumont and the other commanders of the Last Wall. He realized that even by assessing potential candidates in such a way, he was making a political appointment rather than an operational one. His genhanced mind was superbly crafted to multitask, but being forced to play the High Lord's game, when his intent on becoming one of them had been to force them to play his, got under the skin.
There will be someone proven in place to oversee the next phase of the operation.
Venant held his gaze for a moment, then smiled lightly.
Agreed, then.
Everyone suddenly looked relaxed, as though disaster had been averted, with a near miss, and normal service resumed.
Kubik,
Curland said, drumming his fingers irritably on the tabletop.
How proceeds the grand experiment?
Entirely at the discretion of the Senatorum.
He means, does it work? Said Vangarich.
There have been several successful trials on both Martian moons. The investigation of the Tech Marines, Abathar and Gadriel, into the failed experiment to teleport the Veridi starbase from Terran orbit was most illuminating, as was Alquist Arawar's experience handling gravitic technology in the field on Caldera. The Tech Priest Dominus has been removed from military duties and transferred to the Grand Experiment. It is the conclusion of the Project Trajectori and the Diagnostiad that a planetary body could be moved if so required.
Mars, I presume, said Vangarich.
A logical conclusion, given that it is the only planet with the power capacity and the subspace impellers currently in place.
What of Terra? Asked Lansung.
Impossible. The effect on the Astronomicon beacon would be enormous and inherently unqualifiable.
That brought a condemned silence upon them all. For several seconds, the weightiness of their responsibilities became untenable. Better several seconds than not at all, Curran thought, though too little too late all the same. After a moment, Venan spoke again.
What happens when the Death Watch return to Terra?
Curran shook his head.
Time is critical. Each kill team will translate to separate coordinates. Three fleets from Terra will rendezvous with them there.
To what end?
Curran was considering how fully to answer when he heard what sounded like a body of men approaching the library with some haste from the direction of the Cardinal's wake. Thane heard it at the same time, then Vangarich, the assassin, turning towards the door.
It is early, said Curran, but it could be news from one of the kill teams.
He rose from his chair just as the grand doors were flung inwards, and a trilling flock of herald seraphim burst through. Mesring, they sang, scattering over the table and circling the data stacks. Ecclesiarch of the Adeptus Ministorum, here to attend, here to attend, here to attend.
Vangarich!
The Ecclesiarch bellowed, flapping drunkenly through the flock and clattering into the back of a trolley cart, spilling data slates and scrolls all over the floor tiles.
I know you're in here, you and your cronies. Heretics, all.
Loose wheels and weaker legs rattled along together for a few meters, while the lords were still scraping back their chairs to obediently join with Curran in rising. Laurentis halted the trolley cart's sideways trundle with one of his three limbs. Mesring extricated himself from the trolley cart, brandishing an empty vial as though announcing a toast to a vanquished foe's honour. If Curran could profess amazement at how some lords retained all evidence of good living while the billions beneath them starved, it was almost as remarkable how quickly decades of indulgence could be expunged from a man's body. Gone were the pouches under the Ecclesiarch's eyes, the blubber that had padded his expansive white robes, the self-reverential glow of overstated piety. In its place were glazed eyes, black teeth made prominent by receding gums, sunken cheeks whose pallor he had for some reason decided to mask with dark green coal. His beard came out in clumps, stained with blood, wine, and vomit. He tottered on the spot and would have fallen in a second if not for the efforts of an elderly but well-built man in the robes of a senior confessor and a gaggle of sextons and freighters. They looked nervous, embarrassed. Some of them looked afraid. Why would they be afraid?
You look unwell, Mesring, said Vangarich,
his tone one that Curran had heard used by medical orderlies in battlefield hospices.
Why, you look fit to drop.
Suffer in hell, Vangarich. So slick. So clever.
The Ecclesiarch paused, only to hawk up a gob of blood.
I want the cure. I want it. I want it now.
Curran looked from one to the other. Vangarich? The assassin shrugged.
The pressures of his office are great, Lord, the pastoral care of so many billions. The tragedy of the Orc Moon's destruction still affects him, I fear.
Lies!
Mesring staggered through the clutching hands to face Venan.
Tell him! Tell him how you bought me with the cure to his poison for as long as my life had worth to you.
Vangarich and Venand shared a look that gave away nothing and everything. With a frown that the genetic bequest of Rogel Dorn made furrowing and deep, Coolin turned from them and extended a hand towards the Ecclesiarch. He was a metre taller than Mesring, and in armour 4 or 5 times as broad. He could have enclosed the man's head in one hand.
"If you have accusations to make, then I will hear them."
Mesring shook his head so vigorously against his frail neck that Corlin feared he might snap it, arms aflap, striking Corlin's gauntlet like an inebriate attacking a wall and waving the diamond vial above his head as though it meant something.
"Mutants! Poisoners! Heretics!"
Mesring shot them all a glare, his painted face puce with consumption as he pointed finally at Cavallonera.
"Consort of witches!"
The Knight Abyssal appeared to smile, but gave no other reaction.
"Your order is barely a millennium old," interrupted Venand firmly. "Hers is ancient, older by far even than Lord Corlin's, and has fought alongside the very person of the Emperor. Are the orcs not enough? Must we scour the human diaspora for more enemies?"
"Apostates! Traitors! By the throne of Alinor, I am surrounded!"
With a flap of his arms, Mesring parted his attendants and stumbled through them. No sooner had he done so than he spun around again and waggled a shriveled finger.
"There will be no corner of terror that does not feel my fall. You mark me. I know things. The hypocrisy, the lies, the masquerade of the fists, the death of Vulcan, the empty deviants that call themselves their leaders."
He signed the Aquila and spat blood on the floor.
"The Emperor abandons us, and with just cause."
He turned away, looked up and spread his arms wide, as though sermonizing to a planetary congregation.
"The people will hear it all. Only by throwing down the heretic and disbeliever and welcoming the armies of the beast can they be saved. Praise the beast!"
he screamed, spittle spraying from his lips, eyes rolling up into his head.
"All praise the beast!"
The thunderous boom of bolter discharge startled the servo seraphs to flight. The contents of Mesring's head and shoulders sprayed over the suddenly screaming arch-confessor, holding onto the arm of a now headless torso. Venand opened her mouth to say something. Her gaze slid from the dead ecclesiarch on the floor to the pistol in Corlin's hand, and she shut it again. Wise. Vangarich leaned across the table to look at the body, a strange smile on his face. Everyone else looked too stunned to react, except for Kubik, of course. Cavallonera turned to Corland with an arch expression, as though to question whether summary execution was now commonplace on Terra. Corland's bolt pistol slid back into its mag holster with the faintest of sighs. He shook his head.
"Brother," said Thane, still positioned by the doorway, blood on the grey hem of his habit, "what have you done?"